Hello and welcome to the programme. You can visit our website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Today we hear about plans to control the numbers of breeding grey squirrels in Britain by using oral contraceptives, an idea that was discussed here also.
So where it's been successfully done so far is on the bigger animals. Things like wild boar and cattle in Hong Kong have been controlled with contraceptives, and deer and even elephants. But this would be the first time a small, fast-breeding animal like a squirrel has been controlled.
Emma Finn tells us about her new bee business, which will help us better understand our pollinators.
My aim is to help to conserve and enhance biodiversity in Dublin City by increasing the number of bees and pollinators in the city area.
And do not adjust your set. What you're about to hear is true. The story of the sunbathing robin.
I came up to the garden. It was quite a warm day. And as I came up to the seat, he is there with his wings flattened on the chair, basically taking the sun, sunbathing. It's like as if you had sat on a board and squashed it. That's what it looks like. But I don't know, he's just there taking the sun, and then he pops up after a minute or two when he's finished, flies off again over to the pond and has a little bit of a shower.
So another very busy programme ahead of us today. Don't forget you can visit the website rte.ie/Mooney. And please let me begin by saying desist. Stop it. Don't do it again. Don't send any more pictures into the RTE Iron Nature competition. The closing date was last Friday. We had in excess of 7,000 entries. An extraordinary number of you wishing to take part in this competition. And the winner will be announced on St. Patrick's Day, the 17th of March. And there'll be an exhibition at the National Botanic Gardens. So thanks to the Office of Public Works and to Dr. Matthew Jebb for providing their facilities and indeed their support to this project. Let's get on with today's programme. Starting with the panel today, we have Richard Collins, who's in Malahide. Richard, how are you today? All good?
Hello, Derek. I am fine.
And Aina Lana is still in County Clare. Whereabouts in Clare are you, Aina?
I'm where I always was in County Clare. I'm in Kilrush, the Church of the Woods. Rush is an old Irish word for woods. And there's plenty of woods around here that I walk in every day, which is great.
Now, Aina, I have a question for you. Given the time of year it is, and I think I'll probably ask you this every year, but I'm always confused by it, because when you look online, you get three dates as the answer to the question I'm about to ask you. When does spring start?
The first day of spring is the 1st of February. It's Lae Lavrija, which is the Christianisation of Imbolc, the Celtic festival. Now, if you think that the shortest day, the solstice, is actually the 21st of December, and you have the equinox on the middle of March, the 22nd of March, so one is the midwinter, the other one is mid-spring, and halfway between the two, 6 weeks from the 22nd of December, 6 weeks before the 22nd of March, we have the 1st of February, which is the first day of spring. And spring has to do with the light, Derek. Has nothing to do with temperature, nothing to do with how warm or how cold February may turn out to be. It has to do with the length of day, which stimulates the whole natural world, because it's the lengthening light that causes the birds to sing. It's the lengthening light that causes the flowers to grow. And I even saw primroses yesterday, never mind the winter heliotropes, the ones with the horseshoe-shaped leaves that are coming out for the bees. And it won't be long till we see bumblebees as well. So now listen, learn it this year. I don't want to be answering this for the next 40 years. The first day of spring is the 1st of February. Got it?
Got it, Aina. Richard?
Well, of course, that's just astronomical spring. It's not the vernacular spring. Vernacular spring refers to a season. Now, it seems to me that that is a movable feast. Where I am, for instance, it's a kind of interregnum between winter and summer. Now, I measure the beginning of it by the arrival of a very noisy little bird from West Africa, the sandwich tern. When he starts clicking out there, I know it's the summer. And for a few weeks, the winter bird, the Brent goose, will still be around. But after a few weeks, he will depart for the Canadian Arctic. So that little few periods is the interregnum that is practical vernacular spring. It's not the astronomer's spring. But when we use it in everyday terminology, we mean a state of affairs, not a set of dates or sunset lengths or things of that kind. Anyway, that's my thoughts on the matter.
That's most unscientific of you, Richard. You're normally so scientific as opposed to vernacular and what people say, Dutch din alum. But anyway, there you go. That's what you're saying now. So you mean you have a time where you have the sandwich tern and the geese here at the same time?
Yes, there is this interregnum, I call it. It's a special season I look out for every year when I can see them both, or rather hear them both. And that is the sort of in-between, the adjustment. That, for me, is the spring. But that's just here on the coast of North County Dublin or someplace else it might be. Lesser Celandines or something, I don't know.
Depends on where you are and what your view on life is and what you like looking at. Aina, I want to ask you another question now, given that you're a great person to ask questions because you've always got the answers. You, as you would tell everybody, know everything. So, Aina, can you explain how we ended up with a non-native invasive species called the grey squirrel in Ireland?
Well, we did it because, as usual, we were aping our betters and we were aping the situation in Britain, because the Duke of Bedford in 1876 introduced grey squirrels to Woburn Park from North America. In those days, in the 1800s, the more things you brought from other countries, the more you could show off your wealth. They brought over trees, they brought over animals, they did all of these things thinking to show off to the locals how they were able to go abroad and bring back things and make up for the deficiencies in their own environment. So the Duke of Bedford brought these squirrels over to Woburn Park. He also brought them to Regent's Park and to Richmond Park, and he gave them to his friends and relations as well, so they too could share in this wonderful showing off. So as an article in the Irish Naturalist records at the time, in 1911, it was brought over to Castle Forbes in Ireland as a wedding present by the Duke of Buckingham, who was coming to a wedding of the gentry that lived in Castle Forbes. And he brought over a basket with squirrels, six pairs of squirrels, six pairs of grey squirrels. And they were then released when the wedding present was given. They tell us a photograph was taken of the very moment when it was laid before the bride and groom, and the lid opened and they leaped out and ran off into the woods. Wouldn't they be raging if you thought you were getting some kind of a picnic hamper and all you got was bloody squirrels which ran away? And from those six pairs, they have spread the length and breadth of the eastern half of Ireland. So it was a showing off job, as good as the neighbours, keeping up with the Joneses. Totally showy off. And we've ended up then with this invasive species which outcompeted the reds, causes damage to our trees, and generally is a total nuisance and a pain, I have to say.
Thank you, Aina. Now, the reason I asked you that question has to do with the story which has been making the rounds in the British media in the past week or so about squirrel contraception. It says the UK government has given its support to a project to use oral contraceptives to control grey squirrel populations. And I'm wondering, do we need to do the same here in Ireland? Well, who better to ask than Dr. Colin Lawton, a lecturer in zoology at NUIG in Galway. Colin has been studying squirrels since he was knee-high to a grasshopper. Colin, thank you very much indeed for joining us today. Do we have to employ the same methods as they plan to in the UK to control the grey squirrel population here in Ireland?
Well, this is something that's been around for quite some time. This idea of using contraception as a way of controlling populations has been going on since the 1980s. But a lot of the issues we've had so far have been sort of technical issues that have prevented the programs from being rolled out. So where it's been successfully done so far is on the bigger animals. Things like wild boar and cattle in Hong Kong have been controlled with contraceptives, and deer and even elephants. But this would be the first time a small, fast-breeding animal like a squirrel has been controlled in this way. It would be a very useful tool to have. I'm not sure if it's absolutely necessary in Ireland at the moment, but it does have a lot of potential.
Colin, this problem comes from forestry. The foresters are annoyed at the way trees are being damaged by the squirrels. Now, a strange and weird thought occurs to me. Wouldn't you be better just paying the squirrels? What I have in mind is they are apparently looking for sap under the bark, and they damage the tree doing this. And if they create a ring right around the tree, it's cutting the tree's throat. Now, is it beyond the bounds of possibility to create something as attractive as sap and put that out for the squirrels to take, a kind of methadone instead of heroin approach? Is that an impossibility, rather than have to go to this very elaborate thing about contraception?
It doesn't seem that they go for the sap as a food source, because there's very little to actually be gained from it. So they seem to go for it as a sort of sweet treat. It's very much a learned behaviour, that once they've done it once, they realise there's a very pleasant reward and they'll come back again and again to the trees. The trouble about putting something out for grey squirrels as an alternative is they might not use it as an alternative, they might just use it as an extra thing, and you might actually end up increasing the number of grey squirrels and making the problem worse. Usually you would avoid trying to do anything that might entice the squirrels or encourage them that this was a behaviour to be rewarded.
Well, now, contraception for us is complex enough. We have to give doses of oestrogen and progesterone for, I don't know how many days it is, 21 days a month sort of thing. And it's temporary in its effect. Now, how do you get squirrels to do something like that? You lace some food with it, but do you just have a blanket lacing of food throughout the season or throughout the year?
Well, this is the problem. It's a very difficult thing to do, because you really want to be able to give the squirrels one dose and that will do. So unlike the contraceptive pills that would be used by humans, this is an immunocontraceptive. So what it does is it works like a vaccine. It encourages an immune response against some aspect of the reproductive cycle. So a lot of them would target certain hormones that actually keep the cycle going in the squirrels, or it can actually attack proteins that surround the eggs in the females and means the eggs are no longer viable. So you're hoping that you can give them one dose and that will do. But usually these doses would be given intravenously through an injection. But for an animal as numerous as squirrels, you're looking to give it as an oral contraceptive. So these are a lot of the technical problems they've been trying to overcome, and they seem to be making progress with this new project over in the UK.
So this is permanent and irreversible. Once the squirrel has been sterilised effectively, she will never produce young again. Grey squirrels are not terribly territorial. They move around the place a lot. It seems to me that if you do this, you are unlikely to get all of them, are you? And if you are, it'll mean that a minority of females will have young successfully, and their young will be at a great advantage over the normal ones, because all the resources of the area will be available to them, whereas normally they would have to compete with others. Now, the kittens, there might be two broods of three, that's six young per year. Are you just sort of replacing one reproductive system with this reduced reproductive system? Is there any problem about that?
There's a lot of problems about it. Where this has been successful in the past, they've done it with large animals that are slow breeding, long-lived, and it's a much quicker system to, or an easier system to work in. But with the squirrels, they breed very quickly, as you say. They produce a lot of young. They actually produce more young than they need. And so you need to get an awful lot of individuals before you're going to have an effect. Now, whether you need to get 100% of them, or like the vaccines we're talking about with the coronavirus, whether a smaller percentage of the population will be enough to make a difference, that has to be seen.
Well, now, what about non-target animals being hit? I mean, generally speaking, it's a bad idea to introduce any kind of poisonous thing into the environment. Now, the grey squirrel we regard as an alien, but he's here 100 years, so we have to sort of make our peace with this animal. But will other species, which we might like, stoats or whatever, I can't think what, or birds, are they endangered by this also?
It's a risk, and a lot of the times they try and make these things species specific. But I believe that the way they're trying to solve this problem in the UK is by making feeding stations that only grey squirrels can access. But it is a bit risky. And you also have the problem that almost like secondary poisoning, where something that eats the grey squirrel could actually be affected by whatever's been taken in as a vaccination by the squirrels.
So we could be looking at trouble, Colin, for the pine marten, who is doing such a good job at the moment getting rid of our grey squirrels, if what you say is true. Because is the contraceptive not specific to grey squirrels if you're talking about it creating antibodies and all of that? It's not species specific, it's a general one, is it?
It depends, really. I'm not sure exactly what they're targeting at the moment. Some of them would be very general if they're going, for example, after... There's a hormone called gonadotropin-releasing hormone that would be found in lots of mammals, but there may be something specific that they can target if there's a certain protein that's specific to the squirrels. There isn't any information available on what exactly they're targeting at the moment, but it is an issue with these sorts of things. It's very much like leaving out a poison. It could impact on other species.
I see the research they did in Britain shows that more than 90% of grey squirrels will actually visit traps for food. They actually did a very ingenious thing by putting in something that caused their fur to actually fluoresce if they had fed on these places. So they were able to say greater than 90%. But when you think that's not 100%, and all our squirrels in Ireland descended just from one introduction of six pairs in 1911, all of the grey squirrels we have came from just that one introduction. They have a huge capacity to reproduce unless you get every last one of them, don't they?
Yes, and in fact, that's one of the things that I researched back when I was doing my own PhD. We were looking at how quickly grey squirrel populations recover after these control programs and found that there were just loads of grey squirrels in the surrounding area just ready to run in and take the place of the ones that have been removed. So it would be the same here. You may just be opening up an opportunity for animals that wouldn't normally breed to become the breeders of the population. So it is a potential problem here. And I guess they're only at a certain stage of their research. So they're now happy that they're going to be able to give this oral contraceptive through these feeding stations. But the actual next stage is to get them to take the bait that's been laced with the contraceptive and to see if that actually works.
I'm interested in what you were saying about the grey squirrels causing damage to trees. Lady Gregory, who had cool woods way back in the day, had no grey squirrels there at all, used to bemoan the trouble caused to her trees by red squirrels. Do red squirrels not damage trees too?
They can do, but it's nowhere near to the same extent as the grey squirrels do. Grey squirrels tend not to damage trees in their native lands in America. So we are not sure why they do it here but not there, but it may be because there's a nutrient they're missing that they can't get from Irish trees. But the red squirrels and the grey squirrels in their native country don't do it as badly as the grey squirrels do in this invasive way they are in Ireland and in UK as well.
So will the reduction of the grey squirrels perhaps by doing this give a greater opportunity then to the increasing numbers of pine marten, who are their natural enemy here? There's been great success with the reduction of grey squirrels by the pine martens because the grey squirrels have no memory of this. I mean, they were doing something there recently about the scent of pine martens on things, and the grey squirrels didn't recognise it or be worried about it. Whereas if red squirrels detected the scent of pine martens, they were gone off like snow off a ditch. So as a consequence, there's no corporate memory in grey squirrels, and they haven't learnt to be afraid of pine martens because they're not in their own country. Can we not hear it for the pine martens? Are they not the saviour, really?
Yeah, I mean, we've seen a huge crash in the grey squirrel population across the country, but mainly in the Midlands. And there's a huge area where they used to be found that they're no longer found. And it seems to be the pine marten that is having this effect on them. And we're now at the stage where we're convinced that it's this predator naivety, we call it. Basically, grey squirrels don't know well enough to stay away from the pine marten, whereas the reds give the pine marten a wide berth. And so, yeah, we have seen the pine marten having this impact on the grey squirrels. We still have significant grey squirrel populations, particularly around urban areas, so in Dublin and up in Belfast as well. Those areas now act as a potential sink. So if the opportunity arose again for the grey squirrels to spread back through the country, there's loads of them there available.
We have them on the grounds of RTE, and I notice in Herbert Park too. grey squirrels. At the end of my father's road, he lives right beside it, they have built a dray in a tree. I noticed it last summer. But it's a public relations problem, really, Colin, because everybody likes squirrels, regardless of their colour.
Yeah, but that's one of the advantages of the if they can get this contraceptive to work. It's a lot more palatable for people because it's not as invasive, obviously, as shooting them or another method of actually killing the animals. So what you're doing is you're just preventing them from making new little squirrels, and the grey squirrels that are there will eventually die off and the population will decrease naturally. But it's a much nicer way. I mean, people that live in Dublin and Belfast and other urban areas, we don't get to see much wildlife. And so the grey squirrels are an opportunity to sort of connect with nature. And it's understandable that people don't want to see the animals being harmed.
Who's going to decide if this is going to happen or not? I mean, it's happening in Britain as an experiment. Are we just discussing it here as a possibility? Do the National Parks and Wildlife Service decide it's going to happen? Who would decide? And do you think it will happen?
I would be very surprised if it happened in Ireland. I mean, we never had a national control program for grey squirrels, even when they were running rampant through the country. There was a report put together by the National Parks and Wildlife Service and their counterparts in Northern Ireland in the Department of the Environment in 2008 called an All-Ireland Species Action Plan for Red Squirrels. And it was a very ambitious document, and they actually mentioned immunocontraception as a potential novel method of control in there. But of course, then we had the financial crash and all of these things take money, and nothing has ever been done with this report. But I think if this were to be used, it would be on a more local level where we might be trying to remove grey squirrels from a certain park or woodland in order to encourage reds back there. But to roll it out across the country, I would imagine, would be very expensive and probably not possible just on a logistical basis either.
Colin, thank you very much indeed for that insight into the ongoing tussle between the red and the grey. And now the new kid on the block, the pine marten. Colin Lawton, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks very much.
Now, guys, pay attention. Can you identify this sound? Any bird watcher worth their salt will know this is the unmistakable sound of the barn owl. More of a screech than a call. Terry Flanagan joins us now from his home in Dublin 15 to tell us about an online book about a barn owl. Terry!
That's right, Derek. Well, Golden Wings was published as a book about 5 years ago, and it's now been updated and released online, and it's available free to download.
Mm.
It follows the journey of a female barn owl from hatching to starting her own family and all her encounters and experiences in between. It's written by Susan O'Donoghue, who's passionate about wildlife, and in particular birds, and who was inspired to write it after her first encounter, which was with, yes, you've guessed it, a barn owl.
Yeah, so it's a children's book, and it's beautifully illustrated and very short kind of story, take you 10 minutes to read, and it's a rhyming story, suitable for readers from 9, 10 years old and above. And you have a lovely, beautiful rhyming story about the life of Golden Wings, a barn owl, and what her life involves and how she grows and grows from an egg to fledgling herself and making her own way in the world. And then at the end of the story, you have a section with barn owl facts, all about Irish barn owls, and then a section on field work in Ireland around barn owls, so work that Birdwatch Ireland does to help conserve these birds.
Now, you mentioned it was beautifully illustrated by Robert Vaughan. I particularly liked the inside front cover.
So the inside front cover has a whole series of little owlets or barn owlets in different postures. And we have that at the back of the cover as well. It's very beautiful. It's just a little pattern. It's just a little artistic detail, I think, that Robert came up with. So I'm actually very happy with that. It's beautiful.
And there was lots of interesting information. I particularly liked the piece on the pellets. When barn owls feed, they eat the animal whole and they digest it within, but they don't pass out the waste out the back end, but they spit it out. And I'm sure children find this amazing.
Oh my God, yes. Yeah. So I've actually shown pellets to kids and given them gloves and little tweezers and gotten them to dissect the pellets in the classroom. And the noise coming out of all the kids, they're just astounded. When you say that it comes from inside an owl and up its throat, they all instantly go, ugh, and they're disgusted by that. But then next minute, they're digging into it and they're pulling it apart and they're finding little skulls and jaws and ribs and things like that. They're, look what I found, look what I found. And they really get into it because it's a great way to learn about diet and what our native owls eat.
What do you hope children will get from it?
Well, I wrote this book fundamentally for children to enjoy a nice little rhyming story, but also to become more aware of a native Irish species. So there's so much wildlife out there. And sometimes I think kids are so busy learning about zebras and lions and things like that. But it's books like this that will tell them and teach them about what we have right here in Ireland. And I think it'll bring an awareness to them, and then through awareness becomes an understanding, and then a willingness or a want to care for the animal. And I'd like to write more, actually.
It's based on Birdwatch Ireland's latest research into the species. So presumably there's lots of really interesting and up-to-date information.
Yes, there's a lot of really, really interesting scientific research in this book, because this book was funded by Birdwatch Ireland. It's been produced by Birdwatch Ireland. So we've access to all the latest research on these birds. Things like, well, there's one barn owl nest used in this country in Ireland for over 80 years, things like that, that they've found out from monitoring nests. The oldest barn owl that's been ringed and is being monitored by them is 11 years old and still alive. One really, really interesting thing actually that I learned that I never knew about. I thought a fledgling, when it left the nest, wouldn't really travel that far, maybe 5 or 6 kilometres. But there was one barn owl fledgling. It was ringed in the nest in Kerry, and it was later seen in Derry, which was 350 kilometres of a distance, which I found phenomenal now, really. And that, having facts like that in a book, make it really, really come to life.
Sounds very interesting indeed. Is it true barn owl numbers are decreasing in Ireland, Terry?
Yes, sadly, for the last 30 or 40 years or so, I think their numbers are down about 50%. I think there are only about 600 pairs of barn owls in the country at the moment, and the most of those are in Munster. I suppose the disappearance of things like field edges and hedgerows and rough grasslands, and also suitable nesting sites, and I suppose farmers using rodenticides. This is having a terrible effect on them. And really, what most people should remember is that the barn owl is the farmer's friend, because each barn owl is estimated to eat in excess of 1,000 rodents a year. So they're good birds to have around. And I know a number of barn owl projects have been taking place throughout the country, the one in Galway and the one we featured here on the programme a couple of weeks ago in County Cork. They're such a beautiful animal to see them flying, if you have the privilege of seeing one of them flying, and they're silent in flight. And the funny thing is, their Irish name is Scréagh Religa, which means the screecher of the graveyard. And, you know, that's, if you're looking for one, that's a place that you can come across them. They don't hoot, they hiss. So, like, they're a beautiful bird, and it would be great if children become more and more aware of them, and then as they grow up, they can look after them.
Now, Terry, we've mentioned several times this is aimed at children, so did you find a young person to review it for us?
Absolutely, Derek. Caoimhe McLaren is a 12-year-old from County Clare who we thought would be an ideal candidate for joining the Mooney Goes Wild team. Listeners will remember Caoimhe on the programme recently, explaining what happened when she arrived home to find a fox asleep in her bed, and how she brought the story to life. So we asked Caoimhe to read it on our behalf.
Well, to be honest, I didn't know anything about barn owls before being asked to review Susan's book. I never saw one either, but I've learned a lot about them since reading the book.
And what did you learn?
Well, they cough up pellets with skeleton remains and fur, and a lot of them get killed on the road because they fly so low hunting. And they also get poisoned by rats. If they eat a rat, the rat could have eaten poison, and then they could get poisoned.
As you can hear there, Caoimhe has read this book from cover to cover. And I was curious to find out, was there any one section that stood out for her?
So it was very hard to pick a section, as I liked all of the book. But I picked a section from the middle of the book describing where the owlets are about to become fledglings. I'll read it for you now. As they grow and grow, the chicks eat larger food, and they must cough up pellets, which is not considered rude. Look, Here comes Dad with a nice plump vole that is snatched by an owlet and is quickly swallowed whole. Mom catches a young rat on strike and it's dead. To prepare it for her darlings, she then lops off its head. She is the farmer's friend. As she catches rats and mice that cause damage on the farm, which isn't very nice. As the weeks go by, downy feathers disappear. The facial disc develops. Fledging time is drawing near. The eldest is almost ready and likes to stand there, peering out. She exercises night and day, flapping her golden wings about.
Beautifully read. Thank you very much indeed, Caoimhe. More details on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. Just before you go, Terry, news of the new National Wildlife Hospital?
Yes, Ireland's first wildlife hospital. It's going to open in, what, less than 2 weeks now, the 19th of February. It's under the auspices of Wildlife Rehabilitation Ireland. And we've been following this story now for a number of years. We've interviewed people like Aideen McGee and Emma Higgs, and they've had this dream of building a wildlife hospital. Wildlife Rehabilitation Ireland, they're a not-for-profit organisation. Their aim is to promote wildlife rehab and to improve wildlife welfare. It'll be run by a team of qualified volunteers. And it'll take in all types of wildlife from all over Ireland. It'll be a national hospital. And just to give you an idea of how serious it can be, rehabbers received in excess of 5,000 calls, distress calls, in 2019. And COVID has resulted in a significant rise in the number of calls since. And during this setup phase, the WRI, that's the Wildlife Rehabilitation Ireland, are looking for donations of all sorts of equipment, especially animal cages and carriers and heat lamps, etc. They reckon the overall cost for this year alone is expected to be about €140,000, but they hope to be up and running as and from, as I said, the 19th of February.
So fantastic news, and we wish them all the very best of luck indeed. Terry, thank you very much indeed.
Thanks, Derek.
Let's keep moving. We're going to say hello now to Niall Hatch. Hello, Niall. Have you got spring on your mind? We were talking about it earlier.
I do. This is a time of year that it's hard not to think of spring, but I always find the month of February is really an in-between time. I know that they say that, or many people at least, say that the 1st of February is the first day of spring, but from a bird point of view, that's not really the case. All of our winter migrants are still here with us. They're very much still in winter mode. The birds on my feeders in the back garden are still feeding away like it's the middle of winter. And of course, February cannot very often be the coldest month of the year, so we were due another cold snap, I'm sure, before the spring is really here. But it is also the time you start to see the first nesting activity. You see the birds starting to carry sticks, you see a bit of fighting, territorial disputes, songs being practiced. So definitely spring is in the air, even if not fully here, I think.
It is, Niall. I can feel it in me waters. Now let's say hello to Frank Gaffney. Frank is from Blarney in County Cork. And during the week he sent me not one, not two, but three videos of a friendly robin which visits his garden every day. In fact, has become part of the family, really. We let him tell you all about them. Frank, hello. Video number one, please. Describe.
Okay, well, as you say, we'll start with the first one. Basically, it's just footage of our robin who's been with us for the last 3 years, just doing his thing on one of the plant holders. He just comes down in the morning or in the evening or afternoon and just sits there, looks at us, and just sings away even while you're talking to him. It's like as if he's looking into your soul, but it's just fantastic. It's privileged, really. We feel privileged to have him, you know.
You said in your email that he comes when you're feeding the dog.
Yeah, like he first started following me around the garden as a juvenile about 3 years ago. And over time, I started feeding him, you know, a few mealworms and stuff. And eventually he came to feed out of my hand and he'd stay on my hand and feed for maybe 3 or 4 minutes. But then we noticed that when Messi, my dog, would bark, he would appear in the morning. He'd appear in the afternoon when Messi was being fed. And then we noticed that, you know, Messi would get excited when you go out to him to bring him for a walk. When he'd see his lead, he'd bark, and then the robin would appear then also. So then we kind of copped what was going on, is that every time he hears Messi barking, he appears for his food because he associates Messi barking with him being fed also.
So the first video then is of the robin appearing when Messi barks and getting the food. And then the second video is you sitting on a bench out near your back and the bird just sitting beside you.
Yeah, that's last summer during lockdown. I don't know what to say. I can't explain it. Like, he just likes our company, I think.
And do you ever talk to him?
All the time.
What do you say? Do we know if it's a male or a female? Robins are very hard to tell apart. But what do you say? And do you ever get any kind of knowing look back from the bird? Yeah, I understand, Frank. I understand your problems.
Well, he does make eye contact, and he does kind of turn the head when you're talking to him and he's looking at you. So I don't know. Maybe he understands, or maybe he just thinks I'm away with the birds, maybe. Who knows?
Or maybe he just thought you had some mealworm with you that day. But does he often come out and sit beside you when you're sitting on the bench?
Often, like in the summertime, obviously you spend a lot more time in the garden, and it's been on many occasions myself and my wife would be sitting out in the evening time having a drink as you do in the garden
as
up to 10 o'clock at night, and he'd just come and sit on the table or sit on the chair next to us and just kind of looking at us, and there's no food involved at that time.
Like, no food, just, no, just company. Now,
it's just like company, you know?
The third video you sent is the one that really blew my socks off. You describe it.
I came out to the garden. It was quite a warm day, and I was going up to sit down, and I had forgotten my phone. So I went back into the house to get my phone, and as I came up to the seat, he is there with his wings flattened on the chair, basically taking the sun, sunbathing. It's like as if you had sat on a board and squashed it. That's what it looks like. But, you know, he's just there taking the sun, and then he pops up after a minute or two when he's finished, and flies off again over to the pond and has a bit of a shower. So,
and you reckon he's sunbathing?
Oh well, I don't know. I know I've seen birds anting before, you know, spreading their wings like that, but I've never seen any bird do that without getting something out of it. So I don't know. Maybe one of the experts can tell me what it is.
Well, we'll ask them now. Of course, anting is when the ants come on and they take away all the little parasites. Well, yeah. We'll let the guys explain that as well. But you're aware of that, so you don't think it was that on this occasion? No ants around?
I have a few, one or two ant hills, all right, in around the garden near the pond that the frogs make quick work of every now and again. But there certainly was no ants on him that day or anywhere near them.
So, sunbathing robin. Oh, well, they are reptilian. The birds come from reptiles. Nile Hatch.
Yes, indeed. A wonderful sequence of videos there, Frank. I really enjoyed looking at them. And I can confirm that your robin was indeed sunbathing. That's exactly what it was doing. What it was doing was spreading its feathers out, looking like a flat like a pancake, or as you perfectly put it, almost like someone had sat on it. It's maximizing the surface area of its feathers so that the sunlight is reaching as many of them as possible, getting into all the nooks and crannies. And what it's relying on there is the ultraviolet rays from the sun, so the same thing that gives us humans sunburn. It's using that to kill the parasites in its feathers. So it's for a similar reason to anting. As you mentioned, that's what ants lie down on the ground normally, spread their wings out, let the ants crawl over their bodies, and they then eat the little parasites that are in, and the mites and things that are between the feathers. So that's to remove parasites. The sunbathing is for the same thing. It's to allow the sunlight to come in, and the UV rays will kill those parasites. And it's very interesting as well that the bird is obviously very comfortable with you, because when birds do that, they're very, very vulnerable. That's one of the reasons we don't often see it. Many bird species do this, but it's usually hidden away from human eyes because they're very vulnerable when they're lying prone like that on the ground or on a surface. Very easy for something like a cat or a fox or a hawk to sneak up on. And I think what's happening here is that this robin has learned that it can trust you, and you not only provide food, but you also provide safety from predators, because it's learned that when you're close by, the predators aren't going to come close. So it's safe. So you're deterring the predators, giving it food. So I think this robin's onto a very good thing here.
That's an interesting point you made, because I mentioned those blackbirds that are there a while ago. We put out some mealworms on the sleepers for the robin to eat. As soon as the blackbirds appear, he has to come away because they're quite aggressive. But my wife will stand there with some food in her hand, and he'll come to her hand and eat off her hand while the blackbirds are eating within 3 or 4 feet of her. But it's the only way he can get food when they're around, you know? So yeah. I suppose he feels safe in her hand when they're about.
Yes, it's interesting that robins, unlike most other birds, they have learned to associate with other creatures for protection. And in a lot of Europe, in mainland Europe that is, they tend to associate with wild boar, which obviously we don't have in Ireland anymore. So they've had to latch on to the next best thing, which is us human beings. But in a lot of continental Europe, they're shyer birds around people because they prefer to travel around with the wild boar that offer the same benefits. They're providing food by uncovering the leaf litter in the soil. Little spiders run out, worms are uncovered. The boar don't care about those, and the robin's no threat to them, so they're happy to tolerate it. And then, of course, when the boar are around, they're quite aggressive animals, so predators like foxes, for example, or hawks aren't going to approach, so the robin gets that benefit. So it seems it's an evolutionary strategy by robins that they latch on to larger mammals that offer protection and easy access to food.
Now, looking at Frank's third video, which I think is extraordinary, it is a wonderful piece of footage in which the bird spreads its wings out. There are theories that the preen oil spreads better in opened wings and open feathers. If it, preen oil is important for insulation and so forth and waterproofing. Now, the other element in it is the parasites. If you have parasites living deep inside, a bird is a whole ecosystem of creepy crawly things inside them and in their feathers. Now, if you want to get at some of these and defeat them, and you're probing your bill into the feathers, you're very unlikely to catch one of them because these things, feather lice, they wriggle around and avoid the bill. But if you spread out your wings like that, it exposes them. Well, it might expose them. These are all very tentative suggestions. I know with swans that they're full of parasites, and if you wring one or hold one for any length of time, some of them will be on you that evening, creeping around the feather lice and things like that. So I just wonder if spreading the wings is a way of flushing out the enemies in the plumage.
I think, Richard, it's very important that birds absolutely keep their feathers in tip-top condition because they're so essential to their survival. You know, without proper feather condition, they're not able to fly correctly. So they're, if they're flying inefficiently, they're wasting energy. It also insulates them at night so that they can survive cold winter nights particularly. So keeping their feathers in tip-top condition is absolutely essential. The preen oil that you mentioned that they get from this gland near the base of their tail, the uropygial gland, it very much acts like hair conditioner in humans. Now, it's a long time since I've had any use for hair conditioner myself, being rather thin on top. But it is important, you know, for human hair condition, and it's the same for feathers because they have to be kept in perfect working condition. And feathers are incredible. They're masterstrokes of engineering, of natural engineering, because the feather shafts themselves support all these barbules that interlock and create this wonderful, very lightweight but extremely strong structure that also is naturally waterproof. It repels water. It used to be thought that this preen oil was important in actually providing a waterproof coating on the feathers, but it turns out that's not what's happening at all. The preen oil is conditioning the feathers, making sure that they're in good nick and making sure that the parasites are lessened. But what's actually happening is it's the interlocking nature of the feathers themselves that repel water. So when a bird gets absolutely soaked, it usually needs a big deluge of water at quite high pressure, or perhaps if the bird is in poor condition and it hasn't got enough oil in its feathers or there's too many parasites, then they'll take on water. And that can be very serious because it's chilling the bird, it's increasing its weight, making it less efficient. So the birds do everything they can to make sure that their feathers are in perfect condition. That can be through sunbathing, it can be through anting, it can be through preening, zipping up all the sort of broken feathers, putting them back together. But absolutely remarkable structures.
I'm wondering about why we do that. I mean, the bird doing it, it seems there are justifications, at least in theory. But why would humans stretch out on beaches in bathing suits? Is this a purely cultural thing? Something that to have a brown tan meant that you were from a better off class of people. So people would esteem you more and find you more attractive as a sexual partner. Now, or is it deeper? Does it go right back? After all, we're Africans. We came from Africa a few tens of generations ago. We've shed the melanin in our skin because we are not getting enough sunlight in to create vitamin D. But we still have a hankering for exposing ourselves in this extraordinary way to the sun. And you get people who are terrified to go into the water because they might be eaten by a shark. And on the other hand, they'll stretch out and risk melanomas by exposing themselves to the sun. It's totally irrational behaviour. But why is there a fascination in people with doing this?
It's an interesting question, Richard, and it's alien to me because I have skin that's like photographic film. If I expose it to the sun, it burns almost instantly. So I usually go out when I'm bird watching in warm countries. I'm usually buttoned up, my collar's buttoned up, long sleeves, and every exposed bit of skin is covered in sunscreen. Obviously, for a lot of people, it's a very pleasurable experience, sunbathing, the warmth on their skin, the relaxation of it, I suppose. And of course, there are some benefits, you know, to sun exposure, as you said, from vitamin D, which we synthesize through the sunlight. We can't make it naturally. naturally ourselves. In Ireland, vitamin D deficiency can be quite a significant problem because we have such low levels of sunlight, particularly in the winter. So maybe there is an evolutionary benefit that's retained within, let's say, Caucasian people in Europe to expose themselves to the sun. But it's something that I think varies from culture to culture and through different historical periods. In many cultures, the aim is to have as pale a skin as possible because it shows, therefore, that you're wealthy, that you don't have to work outside. And this sort of has continued on to the modern day, particularly in many East Asian cultures, whereas in other cultures, it's quite the opposite. So I think it's partially to do with the vagaries of fashion and partially because it's pleasurable.
Yeah, but the robin isn't going to change colour, Niall. The robin isn't going to change colour.
That's true. The robin is certainly getting some benefits from it. Otherwise, it wouldn't do it because it is taking a risk when it's doing it. So this behaviour would only have continued in evolution if it conferred a survival benefit. So it's obviously doing something for the robin.
Well, I think birds come from reptiles, which is what I said at the beginning.
They do, but unlike reptiles that are around today, birds are warm-blooded. Mm. They descended from warm-blooded dinosaurs.
Yeah, we all like a little bit of heat in our bones, my mother used to say. A little bit of heat in your bones.
Oh, we do, absolutely.
Better.
Absolutely, we
gives
do.
You a bit of a jizz.
And the thing, of course, is that it helps to keep their metabolism going. Birds have a higher body temperature than we do, so any energy that they can conserve, especially on cold winter days, if they're in direct sunlight, that heat certainly would help them. There would certainly be some residual heat on that seat as well that is coming up from below. But I think because of the way the bird is spreading out its feathers so widely, I do think that it's the UV rays from the sun are the main motivation there, because otherwise it wouldn't do that. There's no feeling, there are no nerves, there's no sensation in feathers, and they don't really lose heat through those feathers. So the way it's playing its feathers out in the video, I think it's definitely trying to get the sun to penetrate through and to kill the parasites as much as it
can.
But
really is wonderful video. So Frank, thank you very much indeed. Very much appreciated.
Okay, that's brilliant. Nice talking to you. Thank you very much. Bye now.
And thanks to you too, Niall. We'll talk to you later.
Bye.
There goes Niall Hatch. Now, I was doing a little bit of light reading the other day about bees, given that our next item is about bees, and I came across a lovely website called the Manchester and District Beekeepers Association, promoting the art of beekeeping since 1895, if you don't mind. And on the website, they have the Beekeeper's Year, which gives you details of what the bees are doing month by month and what you, as the beekeeper, must do to keep them happy, and approximately how long you'll need to spend on managing the hive each month, which is very useful for you to know if you get into the art of beekeeping. Anyway, let me just see what it says about January, because I've printed it out. Yes, it says January. The Queen, surrounded by thousands of workers, will be in a rugby football-shaped cluster in the hive. There is little activity except on a warm day when workers take the opportunity for making defecation flights. There will be no drones present, but some workers' brood will be raised. Little work is required at this time of the month, lucky for you. If the ground is covered with snow, shield the entrance to cut off the light and prevent workers flying and perishing in the snow. How much work will you have to do? Well, approximately 1 hour for the entire month of January. And you can go to February, March, April, May, etc., etc. I'll put the link on the website because you might find it useful. Now, there is nothing more welcome than the sound of bees going about their business on a warm summer's day. And oh, how we look forward to that. And it's a sound that urban dwellers and office workers among you may be hearing more of. Emma Finn is creator of Bees on the Roof, a business set up to install and manage beehives for corporations and other groups that want to increase their green credentials and take nature a step closer to their workers. As Aina Nilana discovered when she spoke with Emma Finn earlier from her home in Artane.
My business is called Bees on the Roof. My aim is to help to conserve and enhance biodiversity in Dublin City by increasing the number of bees and pollinators in the city area.
Do you actually put hives on roofs?
I go into buildings and I check them out to see if they're suitable. It's very dependent on what way the roofs are facing. Is there wind cover? And would the bees be able to safely come out of the hives and go out and forage? So they need to be away from pathways and building areas and that kind of thing.
So presumably then, you're doing this on corporate buildings that have flat roofs rather than people's houses which have pitched roofs.
Yes, absolutely. So having gone in, now there's a wide variety of roofs in Dublin that you wouldn't really even think about when you're going around. Some of them have great populations of the herring gulls, and others have little bits of greenery in them. Also, there's talk about going into a school that we would be sponsored by the corporate entities to do the hive project in schools as well, even in their roofs or behind their gyms or wherever there might be a bit of free space that would be out of the way.
Now, some of the I'm just thinking of offices in Dublin and office buildings. Some of them are very high and tall. I mean, could you put one, let us say, on the old Central Bank, which was, I don't know how many, 22 stories high? Or is there an actual limit to the height up at which you can put a hive?
I don't think there really is, because as long as they are not in a wind corridor, as long as they can fly in and out, that's okay, because they're always going off to forage. You have to think like they're going off, you know, it could be 3 or 4 kilometres to forage all around the city. So as long as they are able to get in and out of their hives, it's okay for them. And actually, it's better for us because they're so far up and they're so out of sight that most of the time you're never even going to be aware that they're there, because they've already disappeared from sight as soon as they've come out of their hives. They would have hives in the buildings in New York, which would be much higher than anything that we have.
That is true indeed, the skyscrapers there. But listen, Dublin is a city with 1 million people inside the M50. There's an awful lot of hard surfaces. Is there enough food for these bees? Are there enough wild flowers and plants? Or do you have to also up the amount of flowers and plants that are available before you can really decide to put a beehive someplace?
Yeah, that is the biggest concern. At the moment, there isn't that many beehives in Dublin, but as you increase the number of hives, you have to increase the amount of forage. So Dublin is quite green, as in there are quite a few green spaces within the main city centre area. For example, Trinity, where they have lots of native trees which are planted, which are great in terms of the amount of forage that they provide. So the thing about going into these corporate entities, especially if it's a building that has maybe 5 or 6 different companies within that, is that once I'm in there, and then maybe we've put cameras on the hives, that's 6 different companies that you're going out to talk to about bees or raising their awareness. So the thing would be then the education, that we've put hives here, but you also need to do your bit at home. So can you increase your planting? Can you stop spraying? Can you put baskets on your balcony? Like, there's lots of different things that people could do on a very small level that would increase the richness of diversity in the city. But there is also a lot of mature gardens, and we know that, that have lots of wonderful flowers, and that we also know that cities are a couple of degrees warmer, so it's not as hard for the bees to survive.
You were saying, and put on the cameras. What do you put cameras on the hives? Tell us about the cameras. What's that involving?
Well, that it was just a static camera, so that if you were sitting at your desk, either in the office or possibly remotely at home at the moment, that you could log on. It's a very easy way maybe to take a few minutes out of your day to see nature that you could be connected to, that you can see what colour pollen is coming in, that you could see, okay, say it's 18 degrees, are the bees out today? Okay, being optimistic. But it's 15 degrees, are they out today? Or even 3 or 4 days ago, the bees were out, and you wouldn't expect that so early in the year. But I kind of think it connects people back in with being able to see activity at a hive. What are the bees doing? Are they kicking out dead bees or drones at the end of the season? Or are they bringing in forage, nectar? What are they actually bringing in to feed the brood?
And of course, I presume we're talking about honeybees as opposed to bumblebees or solitary bees. And I presume it's the Irish subspecies of honeybee you use, is it?
It is, yeah. I'm very dedicated. It's Apis mellifera mellifera, so that's the native Irish honeybee, which it's adapted to our environment. It's frugal. It doesn't waste the honey. So it knows that you could have a very bad summer like last year. So at the start of, you know, in spring last year, in March and April, we thought, oh my, we're off for a bumper crop this year. But by the end of the summer, the weather had been so bad that there wasn't much honey that came out of a lot of the hives. And then it was good again in September. And there was a, you know, the ivy came in and they were building up again for winter. But you have to think that, what I do for the honeybees, this one species of honeybee in Ireland, it will hopefully advantage all the other pollinators. So we know that there's maybe 20,000 species of bees around the world, and that it all connects in, the whole system connects. So anything that you're doing for this one species that's managed by us will improve the situation for all the other honeybees and pollinators and all the insects as well.
And you can find more details on our website, rte.ie/Mooney. That's pretty much all we have time for today. My thanks to Aina Nealana, to Dr. Richard Collins and to Niall Hatch, to all of our contributors, our broadcast coordinator, Jarlath Holland, and our researcher, John Riley. Visit the website anytime you like, rte.ie/Mooney. Until next week, goodbye.
Mooney Goes Wild was presented and produced by Derek Mooney.